Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today we come to you again from Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, it is virtual or remote. I am not there. We were there last week. It was much quieter than usual in Washington, D.C. The street, you feel like it's a weekend when you're walking around. It's very strange. But a few weeks ago, I was speaking to a guest who's been on the show many times, Rich Gold of Holland & Knight. And Rich said something that I've never, in 3 years of doing the podcast, I've never heard anybody say this before. And he said, giving a compliment to a fellow colleague in a different firm, he said, quite frankly, Marty Gold is hands down, knows the rules and procedures in the Senate better than anybody I've ever worked with. And something along those lines, and just said he was a great mentor to Rich, and he's learned a lot. And so with that, we decided to reach out to Marty Gold and interview him. He is a partner at Capital Counsel, which John Raffaele at Capital Counsel was one of our first guests on the podcast a few years ago. And John gave me an overview of how he views the business, and I've used it many times since. He said, I think it was the three or four P's that he looks for: people, policy, politics, and then I think he says occasionally I add a fourth, which is personality. Marty can tell me if I got that right, but I've used that very often. And he says, what you want to do, he said, Jim, in the old days, you know, you could really just depend on people and if they had the right relationship. That is no longer true. Clients hire you. They expect you to know the policy, to know the people, and to know the politics. And so it was a great overview for me. And so today we are sitting down with Marty Gold. And Marty, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate it and glad to be here.
So let us jump ahead and start with, how did you get your first job in the Senate? And tell us about that and what you did.
My first job in the Senate was for a five-term Republican senator from Oregon named Mark Hatfield. I knew Senator Hatfield for several years, actually, before I started working for him. I had been the president of the Young Republican Club at American University in Washington. We invited the senator to campus because he was an extraordinarily well-received speaker on campuses in those days, in as much as it was during the heart of the Vietnam War, and he was an opponent of the war, and he was an opponent of the draft, and both of those positions were very popular with students. So we figured we'd get a good crowd if he came to campus, and we were right. But what I learned from that was much more than his position on Vietnam. I learned what a wonderful human being he was, and what a warm person he was, and how he took interest in young people who took an interest in the things that he cared about. And so, therefore, he was open to having an intergenerational friendship, and we began an intergenerational friendship. Finally, after I got out of service in the United States Army, I went to work for the senator. What I could say was that he was my friend before he was my boss, while he was my boss, and after he was my boss, and a great mentor. So he gave me a job working in his office. What I knew about the Senate in those days was really very little. I was terribly green. I was fundamentally ignorant of the subtleties of the place. And I learned what I learned on the job training.
And how long did you spend with him?
With him, 7 years on personal staff and on two committee staffs. And then I went on to work for the Senate Republican leadership with Senator Howard Baker. So the Hatfield experience was really, shall we say, almost like secondary school and basic college, and the leadership was graduate school.
And were you doing, at this point, you were a lawyer, so you were doing legal work for the senator?
I went to law school while I worked for him. He was, just in terms of being a mentor, incredibly flexible. He told me, I asked him to go part-time so I could go to law school. And he said, look, you just work around your classes. I want you to work full-time, but you can just work around your classes. So I would start in the morning at law school and then go to the senator's office after class. Or I would start in the senator's office and go to law school at night. It was not particularly a simple schedule, but never a single time did we ever sort of miss a beat on that? Or was I ever reproached for missing a meeting or doing anything that didn't comport with both responsibilities at once? So he allowed me the freedom and the flexibility to go to school while I worked for him. And when I graduated, I did some legal work in his office, but very soon after that, he appointed me to the staff of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And then after he had to leave that committee assignment because they restructured committee assignments, he put me on the staff as counsel to the Senate Rules Committee. So law school was necessary for that, but I was a law student when I worked on his personal staff.
And what type of work were you doing when you were in law school and working on his staff?
Oregon projects, mostly, federal grant programs, mostly, and then from time to time, legislative issues. There would be legislative issues. I mean, I had a large legislative staff that didn't necessarily need me to augment it. But from time to time, there would be issues that would come up, and they would ask me for a hand, and particularly because I was a law student, and maybe the people handling the issues did not have a legal background, so I would add to it. But it was an amalgam of things. State projects and interaction with the state government, local governments in Oregon, and then a range of legislative issues without specific legislative responsibilities on a continuing basis.
And on the Intelligence Committee, what type of work did you do there? Was that more legal?
Well, it was the first permanent Intelligence Committee set up in the Senate. There had been investigations of the CIA and the intelligence agencies in the middle 1970s, a committee known as the Church Committee, after Senator Frank Church of Idaho, who was the chairman. And one of the reforms that came out of that investigative process was the establishment of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, a committee that exists to this day. So Senator Hatfield was an original member of the committee. Normally, the committee chairman and the ranking minority member of the committee appoint all the staff. And if a senator has somebody working with committees, you got somebody on his personal staff that they sort of assign to committee work. But because the Intelligence Committee involved access to classified information and some of it fairly high-level classified information, it wouldn't work to have Senator Hatfield just assign somebody from his personal staff to work with the committee staff. He had to have somebody that was actually on the committee staff with security clearance. So he recommended me. They cleared me through the security clearance process, and then I worked on the committee staff itself as his designee. We got all manner of briefings on various intelligence issues that came up during the middle to later 1970s, and I was responsible for also taking him to around the intelligence community, a role that he would not have previously played, even though he had been in the Senate by that time for a decade. But he would not have been much involved with the intelligence community. I had to be responsible for all the briefings he went to. But the single one I'll point out that I will never forget was taking him to meet the director of Central Intelligence out at Langley. He and I went out there for breakfast with the DCI, and the DCI was there with one person from his office, so the four of us had breakfast together. The DCI was a terribly congenial and decent individual. It was George Herbert Walker Bush. And I simply had no concept, meeting him as I did in 1976, that this person would ever wind up being president of the United States or even vice president of the United States, although he had had a distinguished career up to that point. But in any case, he was just what people have come to think of him as, a very open, a very giving individual, easy to talk to, and I think very much cooperative with Congress, which had a lot to do with smoothing the relationship that the intelligence agencies had with Congress, because they had gone through a very rough period, particularly during the Church investigations that had preceded it.
And so when you left that meeting, you didn't think to yourself, oh, there's someone who's really, not that you didn't think highly of him, but you didn't think, boy, there's someone who's really going places or...
It simply did not dawn on me. What I remember is that after the breakfast, he took us into his private office because he was very proud of a rug that he had just gotten delivered that he had manufactured in Hong Kong. And it was a very beautiful rug, blue border, white in the center, and then within the center of it, there was a disc with Chinese characters. And what does that say, Mr. Director? Oh, the Chinese characters, they say George Bush. So it was his name, you know, but he loved it, you know, right? Anyway, I will always remember that meeting. I probably would remember a meeting with the director of Central Intelligence, no matter who it was. But the fact that it was George Bush, that made it particularly special.
And when you're in meetings like that, you know, Marty, you said you grew up in New York before we came on the air, you know, going to American University and going to law school part-time. And did you feel a little bit like you were going to get tapped on the shoulder and say, excuse me, Mr. Gold, what are you doing here? I mean, it must sure. You must have been, did you pause when you're sitting in meetings like that thinking, boy.
Of course. Listen, I mean, I grew up in a very middle-class family. My whole family was a family of immigrants. I mean, I was second-generation American. My grandfather came from Tsarist Russia. On my mother's side, on my father's side as well, grandparents came from Tsarist Russia. You know, so I understood from the immigrant experience what it meant to them to be American citizens, what they thought about the United States, and the respect that they had for the country and the political class of people, the people that they admired. Franklin Roosevelt, my grandfather's case, Senator Javits, and my grandfather's case, other people that they admired. I was always interested in the sort of things that those people did. But I had absolutely no reason to think that I would ever be sitting in a meeting like that. And frankly speaking, Senator Hatfield, I said, was a great mentor. And there are a lot of people that he could have chosen for the roles that he gave to me. It wasn't that I was so extraordinary that they couldn't have found somebody else to do those kinds of jobs. Maybe somebody from his state, for example, because I wasn't from his state. But he chose me. Now, my wife would always say, well, you did a good job for him. You shouldn't be modest about that. I did a good job for him. Somebody else could have done a good job for him, too. I was very fortunate to have had the opportunity to be in places like that. Somebody has to be the person that enables that for you. Any young person coming up has to have somebody that enables an opportunity for them. In my case, it was Mark Hatfield, which is why he's been gone now 10 years. His picture is still on my desk because I never forget what he did.
Well, and you took the initiative to help, you know, invite him to the campus.
Yes.
And you also, clearly there was some connection there when you two met. So to your wife's point, yep. I mean,
yeah, clearly, right. Clearly so. It's clearly so. You know, it's just that I had a friend who had met Hatfield at the same time I did. And I said, you know, we never can forget this. He's the most important guy we know, but we're not the most important people he knows.
Well, and to your point, it speaks volumes of him. You're right. He could have taken, you know, had resumes sent in from all the best schools in the country, and he could have found other people as qualified or more qualified than you.
But he
gave you that opportunity. What was it like growing up in New York, and what did your parents do?
My father was a stockbroker. My mother was a housewife. I grew up in the very northern part of Manhattan, north of the George Washington Bridge, in an extremely middle-class environment, went to public schools, right, and would have been perfectly happy if we had never moved out of the city because I loved the city and so forth. But it was a very non-exceptional upbringing. I didn't go to some extraordinary school. We weren't living in an extraordinary way. It was a middle-class upbringing in New York City.
Do you have siblings?
None.
Okay, an only child.
An only child. Yes, I am an only child. My wife is an only child. I have one son. She has one daughter. Her daughter married an only child, and they have one child. So I used to tell my friends in China that we followed the Chinese government one-child policy. But now they changed the policy. Now you can have two children there. But I think I'm a little old to get started making more.
You could adopt. And so how long, getting back to the Intelligence Committee, how long did you work on the Intelligence Committee?
Only 8 months. And the reason for only 8 months, I love that committee. Let me say that. So interesting. The reason for only 8 months was this. They reorganized the Senate committee system at the beginning of 1977 because, frankly speaking, there were too many committees and senators were overcommitted. It's very difficult to do a good job when you are on 5-6 committees. You know, how do you divide your attention? It's not efficient. So a special committee was formed in the Senate to try to consolidate some committee jurisdictions and so forth and to minimize the number of committees on which senators would serve, instead of 5 or 6, maybe 3 or 4. And so in the course of that reorganization, Senator Hatfield had to leave the Intelligence Committee. So I had a choice. I could stay on the Intelligence Committee staff, not assigned to any specific senator, but working for the staff director of the committee. He offered me a job. Or I could go with Senator Hatfield because he was the senior Republican on the Senate Rules Committee and, in essence, stay with him. You know. And so I had the choice, I elected to stay with him. And I had zero regrets about that. But it took me away from the issues from the Intelligence Committee and brought me into a whole different array of issues. It wound up being, however, an exceptionally influential hinge moment in a career, because inasmuch as I started working for the Rules Committee staff, there was an imputed knowledge of the Senate rules because you worked on the Rules Committee staff. It's really a mistake. It doesn't really flow from it, but people think it does. You work for the Rules Committee, you must know about the rules. So when Senator Baker, who was then the minority leader, was looking for a person to add to the leadership staff who could be his rules person, they offered me a job. I knew people from Baker's office because Baker was the senior person on the Intelligence Committee when Hatfield served there, so I knew the Baker staff. That was part of it. But I also had an imputed credential that was also part of it. And it was what led to the transition to the leadership. If I had not gone to the Rules Committee staff, I would never have gone to the Senate leadership, and I think my whole career path would have been different. So making that choice, going to the Rules Committee and leaving the Intelligence Committee, wound up leading to many other things.
Very interesting. And at the time, you were probably disappointed going from the very exciting Intelligence Committee to the, you know, Rules Committee.
Absolutely.
You must have been incredibly disappointed. And yet, in hindsight, it turned out to be, by happenstance, just a career-changing job change.
With no forethought. You know, I had absolutely, it wasn't like I thought, well, if I do this, think of what it could lead to. Because there was absolutely no reason to think that.
Right.
Right. The action forcing mechanism that made all of that happen occurred really a year or 2 years maybe into Senator Baker's leadership. Senator Baker became the Republican leader in 1977. In 1977, the Republicans were in their 22nd consecutive year of being in the minority. And they had fewer than 40 members in the Senate. I mean, it was a small minority at that. But he took over the leadership. And then when he took over the leadership, he heard about all the complaints from all the Republican members who, for one fashion or another, had this or that grievance from serving in the minority for that long a period of time, including a sense that they weren't getting the fair shake in terms of matters of Senate procedure, that maybe they didn't have all the advantages that might have accrued to them if they had somebody on the leadership staff who was actually dedicated to helping them on procedural issues and didn't have distractions with other aspects of a job, right? They needed a dedicated rules person. So after Baker was the leader for 2 years, he decided to do something about it. Who can they offer the job to? And so I got a call from a friend of mine on Baker's staff who I knew from the Intelligence Committee. He said, we have this opening here. You want to come do it? And I told him the truth. So I don't know that much, you know?
And they said, but wait, you're on the Rules Committee. You must know.
Yeah. No, they say, yeah, well, you know, okay. You want the job or don't you?
They're like, Senator Baker told us to get a person from the Rules Committee. You fit the bill. Do you want the job?
Or don't you? So I said, okay. I said, okay. And let me tell you, my first day on that job was the most terrifying day I think I've had in an entire career.
You were afraid that someone was going to come in and actually ask you something.
Terrified.
Yes.
You know, I went to the cloakroom on the floor and I asked a question. What am I supposed to do? And they had two-word answer. Watch Byrd. That's bird watching. It means Robert C. Byrd, Senate Majority Leader, who was at the peak of his influence and the peak of his powers. Watch Byrd.
That's the advice they gave you.
Yes, that's what you should do, right? So I sat on the Senate floor. The floor did not look exactly like it does now because now they have these benches on the back for staff. But in those days, before TV, they had these overstuffed chairs and overstuffed sofas. And I plunked myself into an overstuffed chair, grabbed onto the arms of the chair with a tight grip, and sat there for hours with nothing happening because it was one of those days on the floor where it's endless quorum calls. But I was sure that at any moment, Robert Byrd was going to come through those doors and do something, and I wouldn't understand it, and someone would ask me about it. So I didn't have lunch. I almost couldn't make myself use the restroom. I just did whatever I could never to leave that floor. And hours went by. And when they adjourned for the day, nothing had happened. And I was just exhausted, mentally, physically exhausted.
Because you were tense all day long.
All day. And I thought, how am I going to do this? There must be a better way of doing this job. And in fact, there were two ways to do the job. One was to observe. You had to observe. You just had to get into the rhythm of the Senate and watch what was happening and try to understand it and ask questions if you didn't understand it without making yourself look stupid or exposing your ignorance too badly, right? Too badly. And the second thing you could do is study and read precedents and all the rest of it and try to correlate what you were seeing with what you were reading. And I was fortunate because legislation would come to the floor. I did not have to know about the substance of any measure. That's the committee's job. My job was to figure out how something was going to pass or not going to pass. My job was to figure out the process. One of John Raffaele's P's, by the way, process. And I had to figure out the process. And so because I did not have to trifle with the substance of legislation, but really how it passed or didn't pass, I was free to learn what I had to learn about the job. I didn't have to clutter my mind up with other things that were also obviously terribly important. So every committee's bill was my bill once the bill got to the floor. And when the Judiciary Committee was finished with its bill, it left. And the Finance Committee came. The staffers changed, of course. I was always there. So I got to see the process and capture the rhythm of the process and learn as much as I could. And by the way, the advice to watch Senator Byrd was really good advice because there is no senator in the history of the United States who had a greater influence on the work and operations of the U.S. Senate than Robert C. Byrd. And it isn't because he was the longest-serving senator, although he was. It was because he had two interests. One was West Virginia, and the other was the Senate. And he was such an institutional man that by osmosis, you could begin to see it and pick up on it and learn from him. So he wasn't a direct mentor. He was an indirect mentor. But there was nobody better to learn the Senate from than Robert C. Byrd.
Well, the job must have been incredibly difficult because you didn't have a mentor on your staff that took you under their wing. I mean, you were truly, you know, the first to have that role. They assumed that because you came from the Rules Committee, you understood the rules. And so when you describe sitting in that chair, you can feel the fear. And it's so interesting that they said to watch the leader in the other party. And I can't imagine how intimidating it must have been, whatever small interactions you had with him in the beginning with Senator Byrd or watching him. because he was somewhat of an imposing figure back in those days.
He was a very imposing figure. I mean, when he passed away in 2010, I was at Covington and Burling Law Firm. Every year, I would give a class about the Senate, a lecture about the Senate to summer associates. And in the summer of 2010, the lecture was scheduled for a particular day, which happened to be the morning after he died. I devoted a fair piece of that lecture to talking about Robert Burr, because I told the class, I said, now, if you've watched the Senate for the last 5 or 6 years, you've seen Senator Byrd, but you've seen a caricature of Senator Byrd. You've seen Senator Byrd, you know, well up in years, right? I mean, he was born in 1917. He died in 2010, right? So he was in his early 90s. He was not the Robert Byrd of his early 60s when I first saw him, right? He was a diminished figure. And so people would look at him and think, well, where'd this guy's reputation come from? But I can tell you where it came from, because he was terribly, terribly formidable. And, you know, nobody is right about everything, right? Even factual things. See, people make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes, right? Probably Robert Byrd made mistakes that I never knew about. Once in a great while, he'd make a mistake that I did know about. Nobody challenged him. Nobody. No senator challenged him, because, you know, the price of challenging him on that one mistake would probably be to be embarrassed later on, right? So people respected his knowledge, and they gave him a broad amount of space to do what it was he needed to do. On the other hand, he had great, great respect and veneration, really, for the Senate institution. Now, he was a party leader that has certain responsibilities, but it also means responsibilities not only to your party, but also to the institution. You're the steward if you're the majority leader, basically. And what I can tell you is he had a superb relationship with Senator Baker. By the time Baker got to be the majority leader himself in 1981, the Republicans had been a minority for 26 years. We had 53 Republican senators in 1981, 51 of whom had never been in the majority a day.
Wow.
One of them that had been was Barry Goldwater, who had been in the majority for 2 years at the beginning of his Senate service when President Eisenhower was in office. And the other one was Senator Thurmond, who had been in the majority as a Democrat. Right? So people were a bit at a loss. Another one of those, what am I supposed to do moments, right? And Senator Baker went to Senator Byrd on the first day, because he knew Byrd knew a whole lot more about Baker's job than Baker did, right? And he said to him, can we make a deal here? We will never surprise each other. Byrd says, let me think about it. later on that day, he comes back to him and he says, you have a deal. And you know, they never breached it. Not a single time did they ever breach it. They never surprised each other. And the relationship was a very strong one, a very good one, a very trusting one. So at one point, one of Senator Byrd's grandchildren was killed in an automobile accident, moved the senator deeply, right? And he wanted to talk about it. Came and talked to Howard Baker. It was this kind of a trusting relationship. So formidable figure, yes, but as dedicated to the institution as a person could be. Understanding the role you had as a party leader and understanding the role you had as an institutional steward and understanding how you worked with the leader of the other party who was willing to work with you. That was a phenomenal thing to witness.
Well, to put it in today's perspective, that would be like Senator Schumer going to sit down with Senator McConnell to talk about something personal like that.
Yeah, hard to imagine it.
Hard to imagine. Yeah.
But, you know, I will say one other thing, which is, it wasn't just Baker Byrd. I mean, that's a wonderful relationship. But I'll just tell you something from the era. After Richard Nixon went to China in 1972, the next group that went in there was Mike Mansfield and Hugh Scott, Democratic and Republican leaders. They traveled in China together for 16 days. 16 days! Okay? Or you can listen to the relationship, stories about the relationship between Lyndon Johnson and Everett Dirksen, for example. Right. So these kind of relationships, cross-party relationships between leaders were not certainly would characteristic of Baker and Byrd, but we're not limited to those two.
And were you there when the Republicans took the majority, and what was that change like for your work?
It was an astounding moment. We never expected to get the majority. We expected to make gains. I mean, it seemed reasonably clear that President Carter would lose re-election. Polling showed Reagan was probably going to win the election, although he won by a substantial vote, but it didn't really gel until quite near the end. In other words, the election was a whole lot closer looking in the early October than it was at the end of October. So that it came out in a big landslide for Reagan is the result, but it was not obvious that that was going to be the case if you went earlier in the cycle, and not even a whole lot earlier in the cycle. So the idea that we would have all these coattails and bring in all kinds of people to the Senate, defeating very well-known senators with long experience, was incomprehensible. So we had 41 senators going into the election. What will we have coming out of it? 44, 45, maybe like that, right? We wound up with 53.
41 to 53. That is
41
incredible.
41 to 53.
Wow.
The first Republican majority in 26 years, as I said. We didn't take the House. But we won a number of races with 51, 52% of the vote. Races, by the way, that we lost 6 years later by similar percentages. You know, right? We lost control in 1986 because it was the sixth year of Reagan's presidency. Traditionally, that's bad for the incumbent party. It was in that case. We lost control of the Senate. Okay. But the numbers, the shift in these states was a couple of points. We went from winning by 51 or 52% to losing by that kind of a percent. Right. So didn't take major shifts. But we got all kinds of people elected to office. Some had been in the House, others had no congressional experience whatsoever, and beating long-term incumbents that conventional wisdom would have told you would be reelected. So to have a majority on the morning after the election, or, you know, the incoming majority, was simply astounding, simply astounding. I remember Senator Baker used to have a meeting every Tuesday before the Republican policy lunch of the ranking members of each committee. We have the meeting of ranking members. It would come up to close to 12:30, and then we go to the policy lunch. And one day in December of 1980, they had the ranking members meeting for, I think, the last time as a ranking members meeting. And President-elect Reagan came to that meeting. And there was one staffer in the meeting keeping notes, keeping minutes. I was the staffer. And it's the first time I ever met Ronald Reagan. And I remember him talking about his plans for the early weeks of his administration, basically the reason for the meeting. And I had notes from that because I made the minutes. And I left the Hill and left them behind. Do I wish I had them now?
Oh, boy. And now that you're in the majority, you're deciding, Senator Baker and the Republicans are deciding what to do. Was it a huge change for you?
Immense. It's an amendment. You're not reacting any longer, you know, right?
They're deciding.
Well, and there was a very, very big change because in 1981, we had the first major use of the budget reconciliation process. I mean, this thing that is going on now, everybody's, what can get into the reconciliation bill? What can't get into the reconciliation bill? It's always a huge question for people. Well, it had been authorized by law in 1974, but had only been used in a very, very minor way and at the very end of the Carter administration. But here comes Reagan. He's got big changes he wants to make. He's got budget cuts he wants to make. He's got tax cuts he wants to make. Now, the budget cuts, are they going to be surviving? You know, if they're taken up in individual bills and so on and so forth, maybe not. So the theory was, well, let's put them all in one package and have people vote for the package. This one's ox got gored here with a budget cut, and that one's ox got caught gored there with another budget cut and all that. But it will be easier to pass it in one package than it will be if we split it up. And it will be easier to pass it in the early months of the administration than if we let too much time go by. Because, like with any politician, you know, the sheen will wear off, and then all of a sudden the politician is the president is mortal again. Baker told Reagan, you have until the August recess to pass things, and then it's going to be much harder. So with that in mind, use the budget reconciliation process for the first time, not for the tax cuts. The tax cuts went through a regular order bill, but for the spending cuts. So that was a brand new thing. You know, it was very interesting. Let me just answer a question you didn't ask me. But very interesting, Jim. When they came up with that budget reconciliation process, they were using a piece of legislation that Robert Byrd had been instrumental in writing, which was the 1974 Budget Act. There was nobody who knew more about that process and the process issues in there than Robert Byrd. Right? How could reconciliation be abused? Well, he never expected to lose the majority, and now he's in the minority. He's going to find out how it can be abused. So the budget resolution passed, and it sent instructions to all these committees to make budget cuts, every committee except for armed services, because Reagan wanted to build up the military. Everybody's spending on it to be cut everywhere else. So all the committees go to work, and they come back with a work product. In most cases, the work product is no problem, no problem. But then Byrd is fly-specking this thing with his staff. They said, well, what about this provision? What about that provision? That doesn't respond to the instructions. That's just an add-in. Somebody just stuck it in there because they wanted to avoid a Democratic filibuster, and they wanted to put a provision in a filibuster-proof vehicle. What an abuse. So Byrd went to the Senate parliamentarian, and he said, look at this abuse. He said, this provision doesn't belong there. That provision doesn't belong there. He said, you know, you ought to disqualify this entire bill from having expedited procedure because these provisions that I'm identifying for you are nothing more than filibuster workarounds. Case of first impression for the parliamentarian. So what's he going to do with it? So he comes back and he says, here's what I say. So long as the predominance of the content of this bill is responsive to the reconciliation instructions, and not abusive, a majority, right? Predominance. I'm going to allow the whole bill to stand because the Byrd rule didn't exist then. There was no point of order that you could make to pull things out. So now what is Senator Byrd going to do? Well, he has the right to make a motion to strike out certain provisions. I don't like that provision, bad provision, doesn't belong there. I move to strike. But the motion to strike is a majority vote. He doesn't have the majority. So if the Republicans decided to stand fast on all those provisions, the motion to strike will fail every time. What do you do? And here is the answer to this. He goes and talks about it with Senator Baker. The process is being abused. Now, he and Baker made up a list of provisions they could both agree didn't belong in the bill. Byrd thought the list was under-inclusive, but it was a list. So he and Baker together wrote a unanimous consent agreement that said, these provisions are going to come out. Now, if somebody wants to offer them back as an amendment on the floor, they can do it. But for now, these provisions will come out. And they came out. And nobody offered any amendments to get them back. And then Byrd made a speech, and he said, today we've done all we can do, not all we should do. We have to have a rule that will limit what can go into a reconciliation bill. And Baker made a speech talking about how it was very important that minority rights in the Senate, and he's a majority leader, that minority rights in the Senate be respected and that the reconciliation process not be used as a filibuster workaround. And so that's why he had joined Byrd on that list. It was a very brilliant speech, which I had opportunity to read not long ago. I know it was brilliant because I wrote it myself. But in fact, I quoted it because it's very easy to do there. But that was the principle. So when we talk about the Baker-Byrd relationship and a relationship of trust, you say, well, how did that manifest itself in some practical legislation? There's an example. The first effort, before there was ever a Byrd rule, the first effort to limit what could go into a budget reconciliation bill was the joint effort of the two party leaders in 1981 to limit the scope of that bill. Again, Byrd thought even more should be taken out, okay? But I would regard it anyway as an example of a very trusting relationship and something that was done for the institution, right? So it was a few months into the job when the leadership changed, right? And a very interesting experience, that I can assure you.
Tell us about the Byrd rule.
So when Senator Byrd had this experience, there wasn't always going to be Howard Baker, right? And there wasn't always going to be Robert Byrd either, for that matter, right? That there had to be institutionalized some mechanism to pull out extraneous material from reconciliation bills and to define what extraneous meant. It's fine to say as a matter of principle, something extraneous doesn't belong in that bill. But then, well, what does it mean for something to be extraneous? It's a definition. So you start from this basic principle. The two great rights of senators, Byrd used to say this all the time, I'm not making this up, the two great rights of senators are the right to debate and the right to amend. They exist in any legislative body, including even the House of Representatives, but they don't exist to the degree that they exist in the Senate. There is not a legislative body any place that has the right to debate and the right to amend expressed in such profound form as the United States Senate. Those are very precious rights. Now you take an expedited procedure law like budget reconciliation. It does a number of things, but one thing absolutely it does is to restrict the right to debate and restrict the right to amend. Why should you do that? What's the purpose of budget reconciliation, which I guess is a foundational point? If you write a budget, you're saying revenues ought to be X, spending ought to be Y. You have statutory law, Internal Revenue Code, that will produce a level of revenues. You've just said the level of revenue should be different. You have a number of spending programs that are not annually appropriated, like Medicare, Medicaid, you know, things of that sort. Entitlement programs, where there's a pattern of money that goes out. If you don't change the program, the pattern of money will continue. People can make claims against the government if they don't get their check. So if you write a budget, but you don't adjust the law, the budget is meaningless. It's meaningless. It's just paper. There's a pious hope what you think the spending should be or the taxes should be. You've got to make the law line up with the budget. You've got to reconcile the law and the budget. Budget reconciliation provides an expedited way of doing that, a fast-track mechanism of doing that, to give life to the budget that you just passed. That's fundamentally the purpose. Now, it has been very much expanded upon over the years, but the core purpose of budget reconciliation is that. That's why you have expedited procedures. So why are you going to intrude on the right to debate and the right to amend? Because you have this higher purpose of making sure that the congressional budget actually has teeth. That's why you do it. But because it's an expedited procedure law, it can be abused. Stuffing things in as filibuster workarounds that don't belong there because isn't it convenient? I don't care whether the majority is Democratic or Republican. Any majority has always been tempted to use reconciliation to the fullest, and any minority has always been ready to complain, right? Because it's their rights that are being, you know, intruded upon. Right? So it doesn't matter who's in the majority or minority. It just, you can flip the script. The Byrd rule is put in order to try to keep extraneous matters out of that bill to limit the abuse of senators' rights to debate and to amend, and to give some definition to what would constitute an abuse. So the rule, the process can't be abused, and this is what an abuse means. Now, mind you, some of that is black and white on its face, you know, like the bill contained a fiscal time bomb. You know, it's a 10-year budget resolution. Well, what happens to the government's fiscal picture in year 11 or year 15? Oh, well, in the first 10 years, it was okay, but boy, the time bomb went off in year 11. That kind of thing. That's pretty black and white. You get a score on the provision, and you know what is the economic consequence, at least as predicted by the Congressional Budget Office or the Joint Committee on Taxation. But there are other questions that are not black and white. They are shades of gray. For example, you have a provision that has an economic effect. However, someone says, yeah, it has an economic effect, but that's not the purpose of the provision. The real purpose of the provision is to make these major policy changes. which could get through the filibuster, but they're trying to stuff it into a reconciliation bill. The language in the Byrd rule says that it's a point of order exists if the fiscal changes are merely incidental to the policy change. It's a fiscal tail wagging a non-fiscal dog. The tail can't wag the dog. The dominant purpose of the provision has to be its impact on the budget, and then there may be some incidental policy effect, but it can't be the opposite. That's a judgment call. It's not black and white. Sometimes it's an obvious thing, but sometimes it's not so obvious, and somebody's got to make the call. That becomes the Senate parliamentarian, who has to say, well, I judge that even though there is a fiscal effect, it's merely incidental. And that's a hard thing, right? Because, there always will be advocates for these provisions and who are going to be very disappointed. And then you will have interest groups, members of the House, whatever, say, we got to fire that parliamentarian, or we got to ignore the parliamentarian, we got to override the parliamentarian. The parliamentarian is not a senator. How is she making a ruling like that, right? So the disappointed people, then call for the scalp of a person who is very influential and has no tenure whatsoever and could be fired on the spot.
Well, that leads me to my next question, which is, I have so many questions. Tell us about the hiring process for the parliamentarian. Do you have a good example of a gray issue that has had to be decided?
Sure. So two questions there. The hiring process, it's not formally so, but pretty much you got to be a lawyer, right? Not formally so, but pretty much you should not be coming from a partisan background. It's a nonpartisan office. You don't have partisans in there, right? These rulings are difficult enough as it is, right? Without somebody saying, oh, well, that person just did it because they were a partisan. There cannot be the taint of partisanship on those rulings. For example, Elizabeth McDonough is now the parliamentarian. Is the parliamentarian under Schumer. She was the parliamentarian under McConnell. She was the parliamentarian under Reid. How does she keep a job? Because she's not a partisan, right? She's not a partisan. The rulings that she makes, or that she's not making rulings, the chair makes rulings, but the advice that she gives is thoughtful and reasoned, okay? Now, people can disagree with the reasoning. I don't like that outcome. But what you cannot have is any inference at all. Any inference at all, it was being done for a partisan end. Cannot be that. So a person who starts in the office as an assistant parliamentarian needs a lot of years of seasoning. This cake bakes very slowly before you get somebody that is really experienced enough to take the role of the parliamentarian. I don't remember exactly how many years Elizabeth had in subordinate roles in the parliamentarian's office. My guess is a dozen to 15 years, something like that. And her predecessor, Alan Fruman, similarly, I met Alan Fruman. Alan Fruman is a month older than I am. I met Alan Fruman when he was in his 30s. He didn't become the parliamentarian for years after I met him. So put people in the office, have a legal background, not a partisan background, hope that they will stay because the office is quite demanding. And they will become acquainted with not only the precedents of the Senate, the rules of the Senate, but also the advice that's given to senators. The informal precedents, not the ones that were fought out on the floor where a formal precedent is made, but advice that is given. Because the advice that is given, although it doesn't have the status of a precedent, is still quite important because people rely upon that advice. And you don't want to have a situation where you say, what you told so-and-so, A, you're telling me B. What's the difference in the cases, right? It's the same case, but different answers, right? So even though there's not a formal precedent established, we'll say, there's still a lot of respect to being consistent, unless there are, clear reasons why you can't be. And courts don't always follow precedent. They sometimes reverse themselves, right? But usually they do. And the same thing would be true in the parliamentarian's office. So close cases.
Before you get to that, When she retires, how is the new parliamentarian chosen and who decides that?
Nothing is certain in this world. But I presume that the Lee Hildenbrand, who had been working with Elizabeth and subordinate to Elizabeth for years, but very closely, decisions are made in the office Elizabeth's the ultimate makes the call, but there's a lot of discussion, there's consensuality. You can't go forum shopping in the parliamentarian's office and say, I don't like what this parliamentarian told me, so I think I'll ask that parliamentarian. It's very much done on a consensus basis. And the decisions are understood internally. If they're going to be respected later, they must be understood in the first place. So let's just say my presumption would be that Lee would be promoted. They could try to put somebody in, you know, at that point, but it's very unwise. It's very unwise for two reasons. Number one, who are they going to put in? If it has a partisan inference, bad thing. That's one thing. Second thing, nobody knows as much about the procedure issues as the parliamentarian's office does, because they have the full picture. The written precedents haven't been published for many years, but they all exist in the parliamentarian's office. There are files about things that have happened. And there are, of course, as I'm telling you, the informal advice, because the files are the tip of the iceberg and the informal advice is below the waterline. Who's got the full picture? Who could be consistent with the full picture if you didn't have the full picture? If you had to learn on the job training, if you were just put in there as a political appointee and expect the other people to go work for you. Let me just tell you, I was offered the job of parliamentarian in May of 2001. Former parliamentarian had been let go, or shouldn't have been, there's no justification for it, but was let go. I was offered the job. I refused. And I refused the job for the reasons that I'm telling you here. I mean, I come from a Republican background. I come from a party background. I said, if I give advice that helps the Democrats, I'm a turncoat. If I give advice that helps the Republicans, I'm a hack. It doesn't work. They said, it was a person that offered me the job, said, well, you could overcome it. Nobody can overcome that. Nobody can overcome that.
Well, they probably offered it to you because although you had worked for the Republicans, you don't come across or appear to be very partisan in your nature. Maybe that was why. And is it the Senate that decides?
Secretary of the Senate is the boss.
Okay.
The parliamentarian's office sits under the Secretary of the Senate. The Secretary of the Senate is elected by the whole Senate on the recommendation of the majority leader. So if the majority leader said, I want this parliamentarian out, he tells the Secretary of the Senate, get rid of your employee. And then the Secretary of the Senate will do it. So when I tell you the job has no tenure, right? I mean, it's very powerful and it's very precarious at the same time. It is not my nature to be, you know, overly partisan. But if you came from a partisan background, it doesn't really matter. I expressed at the time, I said, if I take the job, I have to be neutral. I have to forget any partisan affiliation whatsoever. But no matter how neutral you endeavor to be, people will make assumptions. You know, and I simply do not believe that that is good for the institution for people to make those assumptions. They need to make the opposite assumption. They need to make the assumption that whether they liked the answer or they didn't like the answer that they got from the parliamentarian, that it was based on precedent and practice and well-founded and absolutely not on the basis of partisan considerations. Look, that's how the parliamentarian can reach decisions that go against the wishes of the sitting majority. Elizabeth McDonough said earlier in the year, this year, on the first reconciliation bill that went through, that the Democrats could not put minimum wage legislation in.
I remember.
Okay. On this one that's working now, she said they couldn't put immigration provisions in. And why not? Because there was fiscal impact for both of those provisions. But the principal impact of a minimum wage provision is not on the federal fisc, it's on the private sector. The principal impact on the immigration provision was on immigration law, not on the fisc. She wrote a memo, 4 or 5 page memo, whatever it was, about why she decided what she decided on that immigration provision. If you read the memo, you understand where her sympathies are on the substance, or at least it seemed to me anyway, that if she were voting on something and she had the opportunity to vote for it and it wasn't procedurally defective, she would vote to liberalize the immigration law. But that's not the issue. It's not whether it's a good idea or a bad idea to liberalize immigration law. It's whether it belongs on that bill or whether or not you have to put it through the regular order, whatever the regular order means, you know, in the Senate, right? That's the decision she has to make. It's not whether it's a good provision or a bad provision. Maybe she'd like to raise the minimum wage, for all I know. I don't know. It's whether it belongs on that bill. And that's what she has to decide. And so she writes a memo my opinion, very well reasoned. Okay. You could ask me, do you think it's well reasoned because you agree with the outcome? No, I think it's well reasoned because it's well reasoned. And the Republicans, you know, had other issues in their time when they were going after Obamacare. They tried to go after something called risk corridors. Risk corridors were insurance adjustment mechanisms. Because when Obamacare provided that insurance companies had to cover people regardless of pre-existing conditions, that really screws up a basic insurance principle, right? You're insuring against risk that you wouldn't otherwise insure against. The person was a cancer patient, and now you're insuring them against cancer. If you had the choice and you were an insurance company, maybe you wouldn't take that policy. But the government says you have to do it. So how do you then, in essence, compensate the insurance companies for taking on risks that they wouldn't otherwise assume? Risk corridors were the mechanisms for government subsidies, if you want to use the word, to adjust the risk for the insurance companies. When they were trying to repeal Obamacare in 2015, Senator Rubio offered an amendment to get rid of the risk corridors. And Senator Murray, a Democrat from Washington, right, said, I make a point of order against that because the principal purpose of the provision is not the effect on the federal budget. It's going to be the effect on the private insurance market. Parliamentarian says, sure, that's right. Ruled against the Republican majority. So you can find case after case after case where people have tried to stretch the meaning of budget reconciliation, what can go into the bill, and the minority pushes back and says, you know, it's just a workaround. And if you think about it, really, who's trying to do the workaround? The majority party. Because what are they working around? The filibuster rights of the minority, right? Basically, right? So when you're ruling on those kinds of bird rule questions, you're almost inevitably ruling against the majority.
It speaks volumes about Senator Byrd, the fact that he was able to get Senator Baker to make that agreement back then. Just incredible. As you were explaining all this, that the thought came to me that understanding the rules really makes you the one-eyed man in the land of the blind. Can we take a step back and just give us kind of a, this may be a dumb question, but can you give us a little bit of an overview of the rules? And I don't mean the specific rules, but how the rules impact the day-to-day activities in the Senate and how it works and how much they change year to year?
They change very slowly. At least I'll answer the last piece first. They change very slowly. The original Senate in 1789 had 20 rules. 16 of them are still operating. They've been recodified. They don't read exactly like they read in 1789, but substantively they are there.
And 16 of the 20 original rules.
And they have been expanded, you know, over time. Let me put it this way. The Constitution gives the Senate and the House the right to govern itself, right? The right of self-governance. Make rules governing their own proceedings. The framers did nothing more than that. A license to legislators to govern themselves. And how would the legislators govern themselves? Because legislative bodies obviously evolve over time. The House that today is a big majoritarian juggernaut was not always so. In years past, there were very substantial minority rights in the House that kind of don't much exist anymore. Right? And the Senate has, of course, also changed. I mean, the cloture rule was not original to the Senate. It came in 1917 and so forth because of circumstances that gave rise to the rule. So it's not like the rules are frozen into place from the time of the framers. The framers didn't write the rules in the first place. The original members did. And over time, the rules have evolved. But what I would say about those rules in both the Senate and the House is that the rules are pretty much consistent with the constitutional purpose of each chamber. The House, which was always, even in the first thoughts in the Constitutional Convention, well, how are we going to form a House of Representatives? Or who's going to be a member of the House of Representatives? It was always an idea that would be popularly elected. It's the people's house. No person has ever served in the House of Representatives except by election of the people. And we'll give them two-year terms, which was actually long for that era when they wrote the Constitution, but nevertheless, two-year terms because we want to put the people's finger on the pulse all the time. And if public opinion changes, the House should change with it. The whole House is up at one time, and so forth. And so if you are given a majority by the American people, slender as that majority may be at any given moment, the rules and the precedents of the House and the mechanisms of the House give you the capacity to do what you will claim the people want you to do, the mandate that you think you have from the people. And if you're wrong about that mandate, they might throw you out, right? But at least you have the capacity to do that. At the same time, James Madison talked about the Senate being a necessary fence against the passions of the House. Right? George Washington, the story about the cooling saucer and all the rest, right? Some of these stories might be apocryphal. Some of these stories are documented in the Federalist Papers and all the rest of it. But the general point of it is you did not have a bicameral legislature for the upper chamber to be a miniature version of the lower chamber. Robert Burns say the Senate is not supposed to be efficient. It's supposed to take its time, you know? And as a result of that, the rules of the Senate certainly do not build in efficiency. They are a blend of considerations, but as a general matter, they will cause things to slow down and take their time. I teach a class at George Washington University in the graduate school. And I'll give you an illustration from what we talked about two nights ago. I gave them a case study from 2015 of legislation to authorize the Keystone Pipeline. It's an environmentally controversial measure that President Biden just withdrew the permitting for, you know, and so forth. So it's not going to happen. But in 2015, they passed legislation through Congress, went to President Obama's desk. He vetoed it and so forth. It would establish this. He vetoed it because it was controversial, and he did. Many Democrats didn't like it. They started consideration in the Senate on that bill on January the 4th, 2015. They finished consideration on January 29th. Many amendments offered on the floor, lots of discussion, lots of debate, all the rest. Right? Then they took it up in the House. The Republican majority in the House knew that the Democrats wouldn't like it, might offer some amendments that could really strip things out or kill it. So they called it up in the House under a closed rule for 1 hour of debate. Closed rule means no amendments at all. And how long did they take in the House? Less than a day. An hour of debate on the rule to establish the procedure for considering the bill, and then an hour on the bill. January 4th to January 29th in the Senate, and one day in the House. And to me, that case study is a very good argument that shows that the rules of the chambers, although not designed themselves by the framers, are consistent with the purposes, the constitutional purposes that the framers had in mind when they established a bicameral legislature.
Well, Marty, that's a great overview and a great example. Well, we have gone over our 30 minutes by 45 minutes. I'm going to have to, Rich Gold was absolutely correct. It was great to talk to you. I have the feeling this is going to be the first of many visits. We'll have to sign up for that class at GW. But as things happen on the Hill, we may reach back out to you. And so I don't screw up the P's. What are the four P's that John Raffaele likes to, I think process and policy is one or two.
People.
People. Politics, personality. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, don't ever tell him that he didn't get it right. And you interviewed him, so you didn't get it right either. Right?
I didn't get it right either. The P's, the four P's. I don't know, it might be five. I don't know.
However many there are.
Well, Marty, this has been great. Very educational, very insightful. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you very much for the time. And for our listeners out there, remember you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And you can also sign up for our email, which comes out on Mondays. You can do that at our website, thepoliticallife.com. And we hope you all have a great week, and we will see you next Monday.